This week's Parsha is Parsha's Korach, which is a very robust and rich Parsha. Deals with the rebellion of Korach against Moshe and Aaron. And we're going to start with a video. And just as a little bit of an introduction, it deals with a rabbi, Rabbi Elimelech Fier, who runs a non-profit organization in Israel called Ezra LeMarpeh. And he's a Belzer Chassid who never got any medical training, but you'll hear very, very quickly what he accomplished himself and built an organization. So here we go. And for those who are not on video, I will summarize later.
הרב אלימלך פירר הוא חתיכת סיפור, איש חסידות בלז שמעולם לא למד רפואה באופן רשמי, אדם שהמציא, אם אפשר לומר כך, תחום רפואי חדש, אנציקלופדיה לייעוץ רפואי, לכל בעיה ומחלה, האיש הזה מוצא את הרופא המומחה שמתאים לטפל בה. כרמל הוצאתי פגש אותו לקראת הקמת מרכז שיקום חדש בסדרות, כשעל הדרך הם פגשו גם באחד הפציינטים שהרב דאג לו לניתוח דחוף להשתלת כבד בבלרוס. תמונות ראשונות של מאיר דגן, ראש המוסד לשעבר, שמחלים מהניתוח שהציל את חייו.
כמה אנשים יש בפול? אז אני יודע, בעשרות אלפים והרבה יותר.
מתוך עשרות או מאות האלפים שישבו על הכיסא הזה, אלפים בוודאי, חייבים לרב אלימלך פירר את חייהם. הוא מתחיל לעבוד לפנות בוקר ולא עוצר לרגע. מטפל בפניות של מאות חולים בכל יום. בהתחלה במשרד בבני ברק, אחר כך בטלפון. ואפילו את זמני הנסיעות הוא מנצל לעבור על קליונות רפואיים. הוא מעולם לא למד רפואה, אבל רבים מגדירים אותו הרופא של המדינה. פירר כנראה לא צריך את ההכשרה בשביל להעריך מהו הטיפול המתאים עבור עשרות אלפי חולים. אותם יפנה לרופא המתאים בארץ ובעולם. אין יום שהוא לא עובר בכמה בתי חולים מבקר מטופלים ששלח. אין
אדם שיש
רפואה שלמה. מקיים את התייעצויות מקצועיות עם רופאים בכירים.
מה קרה על האור?
זה לא חצה שני ארוכים.
יש לך לדר על עידון לפרוס.
כן, ברנסטורמינג תמיד כיף לעשות איתו, כי המוח שלו הוא משהו גאוני לגמרי. הוא יודע לקרוא סיטי, MRI, אוטרסאונד, אנגיוגרפיות, דוחות פתולוגיים, הוא יודע תמיד להבחין אם זה רציני או חסר פה משהו. לא כדאי לשאול עוד שאלה.
איך אתה עובד נכון? אני שואל עוד בבוקר ועד 11 בלילה.
ומה?
אני מתעסק בדבר הזה במשך 30 שנה.
בלימוד של רפואה?
בעיסוק בנושא רפואה, בלימוד, בעדכון, בפרקטיקה. זה רופא נורמלי, רואים 10 אנשים ביום, 15 אנשים ביום. הרב עונה בערך 200-250 תשובות ביום. משכפל את זה, כפול 30 שנה. ויש לך גוגל מלך.
כל זה התחיל לגמרי במקרה לפני למעלה מ-30 שנה. חבר שהיה בצרה הזיק את אלימלך פירר שהיה אז רק ב-24, שארגן עבורו מבצע הצלה חוצה יבשות. פירר התייעץ בדרך עם הרופאים מהגדולים בעולם, והציל את חייו של החבר. מאז הסיפור עבר מפה לאוזן, והפניות לא הפסיקו לזרום. כשהבין שהוא הולך להקדיש את חייו לעזרה לזולת, הקים את עזרה למרפא. עמותה שמספקת לחולה בחינם את כל מה שמערכת הבריאות לא נותנת. טיפולי פיזיותרפיה, ריפוי בעיסוק, בריכה טיפולית, ואפילו צי אמבולנסים להובלת חולים נזקקים.
כל השירותים של עזרה למרפא, הכל היה לפי זעקת הציבור. אף פעם לא יזמנו משהו שלא היה ביקוש של הציבור, או מה שראינו שהציבור זקוק לזה. והעובדות מדברים על עצמם, העובדה שיש מועדים להסתבר, שאנשים מחכים חודשים, שמתקבל לשיבור.
I'm making a lot of progress here. I came here the first time in a wheelchair, and now I'm walking with a cane, and Bezat Hashem, I'll have a refuah shlema.
Sure. It looks like stuck there. I wish you all the best. I wish it continues to progress.
Thank you very much.
אבל העשייה שיקום הוא עבודה מאוד מאוד סיזיפית, כדי להגיע תוצאות מאוד מאוד קטנות. וזה רק פה.
הוא גיא מטופל במרכז השיקום כבר שנתיים, טיפולי פיזיותרפיה שהוא לא מקבל בשום מסגרת אחרת. אל הרב פירר הגיע אחרי שהרופאים באיכילוב במשך 4 שנים לא הצליחו להבחן את הגידול שמתפתח לממדי ענק ברגלו של גיא. כשהגיע לפירר בתוך חצי שעה שמע ממנו את דעתו. מדובר בגידול סרטני. הבחנה שלא רק הצילה לו את הרגל, אלא החזירה לו את התקווה.
הייתי אומר אפילו מנטור, זאת אומרת, אני רואה פה כדמות, זה דמות כבר שהיא מעבר אפילו בשר ובדם, כי האדם הזה כל כך צנוע, הוא כל כך טוב לב, זאת אומרת, אתה מגיע אליו, אתה בא פה למקום הזה, לכל הארגון הזה, אתה מרגיש שזה רק נתינה, זה רק לתת, וזה לא לקחת, אתה יודע, פשוט זה נתינה נטו.
נגיד, היית לוקח שם פקיד דואר שעובד במשכורת ועל ידם תשים פקיד דואר שמתנדב מי ייתן את השירות יותר ואיך נספק שמתנדב כשהבסיס הוא אלטרואיסטית התוצר הוא תוצר הוא הרבה יותר טוב כל השירות, כל הפעילויות יבלה הרבה יותר רגש
הרב, מה מניעה?
מה המניע?
איך זה צמח?
המניע הוא עזרה לזולת. זה המוטיבציה.
אבל למה המוטיבציה האישית? הסיפוק הפנימי בזה שאתה עוזר למישהו?
למה אתה סיפור גם אם לאן? סיפור זה חובתי כיהודי, חובתי כאדם.
המטופל הבא שלו השתחרר לפני יומיים בבית החולים איכילוב.
All right. Okay, so this is, for those who do not have the benefit of the video, let me just summarize. So you had a video of Rav Eli Melech Fuhrer, who basically 30 years ago, one of his friends reached out to him because the person had a very severe condition, and the various physicians were not able to get a proper diagnosis or a proper help. And what he did was he started by, calling and researching and trying to find what would be the best therapy, the best doctor, the best hospital. Well, the person, he saved that guy's life. And then another person reached out to him. And then another person. And this person, even he's a Baba Verchassid with no medical training, as you saw from the professor at Ichilov Hospital, I guess near Tel Aviv, says he reads CAT scans, MRIs, he's completely versant with, all kinds of, the latest technology, the research, the facilities worldwide, and he's dealing with between 200 and 250 inquiries of medical challenges per day. People who have gone through the medical system has not been able to solve. He's the, as he says, the Israel's national physician. And he's able to diagnose better than many of the clinicians and top professors of medicine. He's involved in discussing it with them, and he comes up with tremendous insights. He reads reports. If he sees something missing, he finds out stuff. He views that as not just a peer, but sort of this tremendously gifted individual. And he created this foundation or, nonprofit NGO called Ezra Lamarpe. And they provide supplemental care beyond that the national service, national medical system in Israel, because they have socialized medicine, provides. And they asked him, I think the key element there is, what's your motivation? What did he say? Who caught that part? Danielle, what did he say?
Ulterior motive to do it. It's just helping people.
Right. He says, my duty as a Jew, it's my duty as a human being to help somebody. Period. Not for the satisfaction. At the end of the video, you guys can, click it. At the end of the video, it's a 12-minute video. I'm not going to show the whole thing. He says his one tefillah, his one aspiration, is that he does not develop a sense of indifference to the obviously hundreds of people that come for him to help. Because obviously as time goes on, you can develop a sense of clinical indifference. So which takes us to our questions. Number one, what value does the rabbi place on human life?
Important.
I would say it's he views it as a supreme importance. The guy's, what's his hours, Julie? I don't know if you caught that.
I think he doesn't sleep.
Right. He's like starting like before dawn. He's getting up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning until 11 at night. So the guy is like doing 18-hour-a-day, 6 days a week. The guy's unbelievable. So in addition to being tremendously talented, and he is driven, the guy, and he has, you know, he's on the phone dealing with various, and he has an assistant who's, you know, helping him sort of catching all of his things, and helping, you know, getting people into proper medical care. And the end of the video deals with Mayor Dagan, the former head of the Mossad, who had a liver thing, and he arranged a special liver transplant in Belarus, you know, the former Soviet Union, and was healed. So even though the Mayor Dagan himself is like a secular Jew, and right, Eli Melachir is a Belzer Chassid, they have tremendous, valuing, and it also intimated that it actually helps the, since he's a very smart guy, he actually helps the Mossad in other areas. So, okay. Next question. In what way is the rabbi's medical work an avoda? Avoda means like avodas Hashem, service to God. Shira?
Giving back in a way the Torah says we're supposed to, you know, besides be a light unto other nations, you have to treat people the right way. I mean, he's taking all the things that we're supposed to do and sort of going to the next level with them.
Right. I mean, to heal somebody is many mitzvahs. First of all, v'yahat rechemoch, you love your fellow Jew as yourself. You have to be concerned about the well-being of a fellow Jew. Hey. Two, you should not stand idly by the blood of your fellow Jew. So if you have the capacity to help them, you have an obligation to help them. Three, there's Vashivoso lo, you should return it to him, which the Talmud, which is a topic for another area. But if just as you're obligated to return a lost object to a Jew, if a person lost their wallet, you have to return it to them. So too, you have to certainly return their well-being and health. So there's an obligation to heal somebody. He views it as a service, and he's committed 1,000%. Question number three, is a rabbi interested in recognition? Why or why not?
I don't think that he really is, because reward he gets from his work is like helping people, not, medals or anything like that.
Right. He's not doing it, in fact, they asked the question, so why is he only allows interviews like every 5 years. So why was he doing it? Because, Julie would appreciate this, because he has to raise money to build the new rehabilitation center in Sderot, so he has to let people know what he's doing. But other than having to raise the money for the new facility, he doesn't want to be interviewed. He wants to be completely, completely below the radar. And he's just interested in doing, a person would not want to get a medal for going to shul on Shabbos one time, because you're doing it for the intrinsic reason. Okay, now. Question number four, how does the rabbi's interest in recognition differ from other exceptional doctors and scientists?
Well, a lot of other doctors and scientists might be interested in recognition for its own sake, kind of to make their name very well known. And in the rabbi's case, the only reason he's looking for recognition isn't so that people say about him, like, oh, what a great rabbi this is, but just so to promote his cause and to help people.
Right. In other words, if he was really interested in, you know, getting more honor, he would get a degree. He would, you know, he would really be involved in, you know, like, which is the main theme of America in 2016. He'd be involved in self-promotion. You know, the whole essence of all reality TV is about self-promotion, promoting your personal brand.
Bobby Penny, just out of curiosity, because it wasn't covered in this, so he already said, like, it's not for the money, that he thinks volunteers do, just out of the kindness of their heart, they're performing these duties, you know, with even more sincerity than, you know, people who are paid to do it. But how is he running this institution?
Well, he has a nonprofit, and he accepts donations.
So the recognition, though, like getting publicity for his work, you know, helps funds it.
And I encourage you to watch the whole video. I only did 5 of the 12 minutes. But later in the video, he talks about that very issue, is that he basically refuses all interviews. So he didn't do an interview for like 6 or 7 years. And why? Because he had to let people know that he's trying to raise money for this new... You can't do a capital campaign completely quietly. So he had to do the recognition about what the Ezra LaMarpez is doing, and, you know, and to share the story. His argument is that volunteers will oftentimes do a better job. I mean, I think the caveat is that provided that they are, you know, if they are bought in on the mission, you know what I'm saying, then they are personally vested, they're getting another satisfaction. Now, I don't think they're necessarily going to get, I think he's the next level up. They might do it for because they want to feel good about themselves, etc. He seems to be doing it for a very noble reason, etc. So that gets to question number 5. Why do exceptional doctors and scientists need the Nobel Prize?
Once the reason they're recognized doctors is because their name is out there. So at a certain point, it's about, you know, making sure they're known for their work. They want to be known for the research that they do. So there's a different motivation at play there.
Right. Or reality, like most things, it's not one or the other. It's obviously a combination, you know? And that gets into the question number six, what does the need for prize and recognition say about the fulfillment one is getting from the intrinsic service itself? What do you guys say?
Well, it seems to imply that happy doing good. Seems that some of their fulfillment comes from people knowing for what they've done and about their recognition and acclaim, not just their satisfaction of their accomplishments. But they need other people to recognize them.
Correct. In other words, the satisfaction of doing the good work, of whether it be in medicine or science research, is not sufficient enough as a motivator. They need an extraneous motivation of people's recognition and people's love and admiration. Okay? So, and again, we're not judging people. We're just saying it. We're speaking descriptively, not proscriptively. You know what I mean? So the bottom line is, and oftentimes it's a mixture. It's a certain, and depends, and not only that, it depends on the day. Sometimes a person will get intrinsic satisfaction from the love and the appreciation of the art of medicine and the satisfaction of really helping people. And some days it's rough, and the fact that somebody's giving you a pat on the back and or giving you an award for excellent service is a necessary motivator. The answer is you need both. But apparently, that's why this guy is recognized, whether it be, you know, religious or not religious, old or young, you know, people recognize this guy is just an exceptional guy. And now, I'm bringing that to your attention because this gets into the area of modesty. In other words, and we're going to learn a little, which of course is very relevant, and you'll soon see that if you not already could figure it out yourself with the character of Korach. But most time in Judaism, when you hear about modesty, what do people talk about? What context is modesty often talked about? Okay, I can't hear. Say again.
Clothing,
right. In other words, sexual modesty. But is that the only modesty? We're going to find out. I think I'm going to shock you guys that that's not really the only modesty. In fact, from the perspective of the verse and the Talmud, that's not even the essential modesty. Not saying it's not important, but it sort of got more play than it sort of deserves. Okay, let me just give you kind of sort of like an introduction. Who could read that out loud? Shira, loud, read a little box.
Sense of a human condition. This realistic sense is reflected in a way.
Shira, start again because we didn't hear the first part.
The modest person has a realistic sense of the human condition. This realistic sense is reflected in the way the modest person engages in proper avoda. Proper avoda is productive of real value for mankind, as is such provides a life meaning for the doer.
Or in other words, that the person does it because he or she sees the activity has intrinsic worth, intrinsic meaning, and insofar as the person wants to live a life of meaning, he or she is happy to do the activity, whether people know about it or they don't know about it. In contrast, go to the second sentence, next little paragraph.
The immodest person has an unrealistic sense that mankind should serve his need for recognition and greatness. The immodest person lacks understanding of the intrinsic value of their proper act of service. Instead, avoda is hijacked to realize their own boundless need for recognition.
Okay, so immodesty is about seeking the boundless need for recognition and greatness. Okay? Now I'm going to, does anybody know, without looking at the thing, does anybody know what the biblical source of Sniut is? I mean, overtly, or the most famous verse? Anybody heard nowhere? What book is that from? Anybody know? All right, good. So it's already a win. Okay. It's from the book of Micha, which is in the book of Prophets, the 12 prophets, and okay. So I'm going to read the Hebrew because you sometimes need the Hebrew as well. It said, "Higid lecha adam matov, tell me, it has been told to you, man, what is good. Uma Hashem deresh mecha, what God seeks of you. Kim asot mishpat, to do justice." Va'ava chesed, and loving, and to love mercy and kindness. Va'tznei lechet im Elokecha, and to walk modestly with your God. Okay? So, so basically it's doing mishpat, loving kindness, and walking modestly with God. Okay? Let's take a little journey to what the Talmud says. All right, let me have, who would like to read? Any volunteers to read? All right, Jessica.
From
Sukkah 49B. Yeah.
I won't. Okay, I was going to say, because I can't read.
I'm not going to have you read the Talmud. Okay.
Okay. What is the implication of the text? It has been told to you, O man, what is good, and what the Lord requires of you. only to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. To do justly means to act in accordance with justice. To love mercy refers to acts of loving kindness. And to walk humbly with your God refers to attending to funerals and providing a bride with a dowry for her wedding. Now, can we not make
an a fortiori deduction, what they call in Hebrew or in Gemara, like a kal vachomer, going from the minor case, the known case, to the major case, from the minor to the major. Okay, go on.
If in matters which are normally performed publicly, the Torah says to walk humbly, how much more so in matters that are normally done privately?
Now, interesting. The Gemara says, what are the two cases? What we're talking about? That you have to act humbly. What two mitzvot do they talk about? What are the two mitzvot talking about here?
Funeral and wedding?
Correct. The attending a funeral and bringing the bride in. So either escorting the bride or providing for the bride or rejoicing with the bride. So these are mitzvot that the Gemara sees that the verse of walking humbly with God is in the performance of public mitzvot. Okay? Alright, so now when you learn a piece of Gemara, the commentary, who's a commentary of choice for all text of the Talmud? Who's the commentary of choice?
Rashi?
Rashi's correct for 500 points on the square. Correct. So we're going to do Rashi. Here we go to Rashi. Okay. All right, Jessica, keep on going. Let's see. Rashi explains the two cases.
Attending to funerals and providing a bride with a dowry for her wedding. Kohelet, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the wedding hall. Yet even in the case of the wedding, you need to conduct yourself with modesty, to eat a proper amount, rejoice with levity. Others say acting modestly if the wedding and funeral means. If you need to pay for a poor person's funeral or wedding, you should do it discreetly and not mention it before others who are unaware that you contributed to these poor people.
Okay, so first of all, let me unpack why this is extremely significant and will now, in a certain sense, expand your horizons of the concept of sniut, modesty. The quintessential examples that the Talmud talks about what is being modest is how you perform your public mitzvot. And they say, if you're obligated to perform your public mitzvot with discreetness, how much more so mitzvot which are done privately? So there are two public mitzvot, a wedding. So what does Rashi say? That when you do that, what's the nature of your conduct?
Says eat the proper amount, rejoice the proper amount. So don't make a fool of yourself. Be there to celebrate, but do it respectfully.
Right, because what's the nature of what do weddings generally bring out?
Drunk people.
What?
Drunk people.
Right. So basically, it's an opportunity to act out. So one way of acting out is to stuff your face. Second way of acting out is drink and get drunk. Third way of acting out is dance around like a madman. You know what I mean? So now there's an obligation to rejoice before the bride and groom. But again, everything has to be, everything has to be sort of measured. Yeah, in other words, the definition is it has to be for the interest to make the bride and groom happy, and not a function of you promoting your personal brand. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, or it could be in shul, when a person's davening, that they shouldn't, make a big spectacle, and hey, everybody see me, I'm Mr. Davening guy or gal. You know what I'm saying? Or I'm doing the mitzvah tzedakah. Let, you know, check it out. I'm doing the mitzvah tzedakah. Or I'm going over to visit the old people at the home. You know what I mean? Basically, the nature of a mitzvah that can be easily hijacked. So it's tznius. Now, obviously, now you understand tznius, of course, applies to, so if a woman dressed in a sexually provocative manner, she's trying to promote her own brand, which is problematic because, first of all, you know, that she's denying who she really is. She's sort of denying the inner humanity of herself, and she's reducing herself to an object, you know, a sex object. That's one problem. All right, but the key point here is the main thing that the Gemara talks about is what people don't focus upon is that tznius of walking humbly before God, of knowing your place before God, is not using the mitzvot as a way of self-promotion, self-aggrandizement. Now, all you got to do is turn on CNN and MSNBC or Fox and just watch, if you've watched the presidential campaign for even 12 seconds, it's been about the complete opposite of tznius. Everything about the campaign is all about self-promotion, self-aggrandizement, and then, of course, being vicious to the other person. Okay, so we don't have to dwell upon that. All right.
Rabbi?
Yeah, choose.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So I think I was reading, I don't remember, maybe Rabbi Tversky, but about you have to have like the right amount of modesty.
Sure.
So that you promote yourself sufficiently, but that you don't go over the top. Which I think it's a hard balance.
So. Right. Well, everything in life is a hard balance. But he's talking about going back to the area of sexual modesty. Right. So if a girl dresses in the equivalent of a burqa, it might be very tznius, but she's you know, crushing her personal identity and her femininity and a measure of her self-expression. So that's also not good. You know what I mean? There's got to be a balance. So sort of, you know, halacha creates a framework, creates a boundary, creates a structure. You know what I'm saying? Where there's a balance of these two things. You know, and then there are what they call stringencies in tznius. But again, it's until a person covers the basics, a person should not really get involved in the stringencies in anything. So, I don't know what you're referring to, but if that's what he was talking about, I think that's the general concept. But here, the Torah, the Gemara, is not talking about one eye-opening point is that the Gemara is not talking about sexual tznius at all. Its first expression of tznius is what? How you perform mitzvot. And you have two categories of mitzvot. You have public mitzvot and private mitzvot. And even the public mitzvot, a person should not try to use the mitzvot as being a vehicle of self-promotion. Because you're basically saying, going back to what we discussed earlier, that's not about the intrinsic value of the mitzvah of helping the bride and groom have a fantastic wedding, or ensuring that the needs of the mourners and the deceased are taken care of properly. It's all about what? It's about using the opportunity for grandstanding, self-promotion, and building your personal brand. You know what I'm saying? So that's the area which you have to watch out about. Which is the nature of man is to be not tznius. Because everybody likes attention, and everybody likes, everybody wants to feel, everybody likes attention, everybody likes recognition and greatness. So, again, everything has to be done in moderation. Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
So this would be probably where tzedakah comes in? Like, isn't the highest form of tzedakah to give, to give anonymously?
Yeah.
From the same idea?
Yes. Yes, because you're doing it. That's why the example of the funeral, according to the second position in Rashi, is that let's say the people had difficulty covering the cost of the funeral, and you write them or the funeral parlor $1,000 check to help cover the action, right? So after you've done that, you don't mention that to anybody. The highest level of sneeze, you don't mention that to anybody. You don't let anybody know that you did that. You did it completely on the DL. You helped the people out, and you didn't do it to promote your personal brand like, hey, I'm an awesome person. You know? Question. All right. Michael Doe's welcome. Any question? I heard something in the various calls. Anybody? Okay, with these series of introduction, let's get into the actual. Yeah.
Because you seem like, how would that even work?
Say that again. What?
A week ago, but you just weren't doing it before. You weren't on it before.
Okay.
I turned it off when you came in.
Okay.
All right. Let's continue on. All right. Who would like to read the parsha? Parsha's Korach. 38th Parsha. All right, Shira, again, let's read the Parsha. Let's get into it. Kahat, Kahoth. All right.
Kahat and the great-grandson of Levi began a rebellion along with Dathan and Abiram, the son of Eliab, on the son of Caleb, descendants of Reuben. They had a confrontation with Moshe along with 250 Israelites who were men of rank in the community, representatives at the assembly and famous. They demonstrated against Moshe.
All right, so stop right there. So who's part of Korach's coalition?
The sons of Reuben.
Yes, Datan Vaviram and On, the son of Peleth, who are descendants of Reuven, and who else?
Of the Israelites.
How many?
Maybe 250 Israelites.
Right, and what kind of people are they?
High ranking.
Right, so he got a coalition of very, very significant aristocratic Jews. All right, let's keep on going. So obviously you know that this guy Korach is a very skilled individual because he's able to build a coalition of, significant Jews. Go on.
Heard this, he threw himself on his face. Then he spoke to Korach and the whole party. Tomorrow morning, he said, God will show that he knows who is
who is his
and who is holy, and he will bring them close to him. He shall choose those who shall be allowed to present offerings to him. This is what you must do. Let Korach and his entire party take fire pans. Tomorrow, place fire on them and offer incense on them before God. The man whom God chooses shall then be the Holy One. You, sons of Levi, have also gone too far. Moshe tried to reason with Korach. Listen to what I have to say, you sons of Levi. Isn't it enough that the God of Israel has separated you from the community of Israel? He has brought you close to him, allowing you to serve in God's tabernacle and to minister as the community's leaders. Although he gave this privilege to you and all your fellow Levites, you are now also demanding the priesthood. It is actually against God that you and your party are demonstrating. After all, who is Aaron that you should have grievances against him?
Okay, so it works out those 250 guys are from which tribe?
Levi.
All right. Okay, so let's go with some basic questions here. Number one. What was Korach's status in Israel? All right, Sean.
He was a leader.
Right, he's a Levi and he's a leader. Correct. Number two, what intrinsic values produced by the avoda of the tribe of Levi of which Korach was a member? What did the Levium do? Anybody know? What? Say it again?
They took care of the Beit HaMikdash and carried the utensils and... not the Beit HaMikdash, the Mishkan.
Correct. So they were involved in the assembly and disassembly and carrying, A. They provide an honor guard around the Mishkan, B. And C, of course, they sing. Everybody knows about that. They sing in the Mishkan. They're the choir. They're the band. Okay? When they do the morning and afternoon service, when they sing the song of the day, what we call the Shir Shel Yom, they would be the orchestra and the choir. So, is that intrinsically valuable?
Yeah, you would think so.
You would think so. That goes to question number three. Was Korach satisfied with the intrinsic value of his service?
No.
No. How do you know?
Because he wanted Aaron's place.
He wants to be not just a Kohen, but the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. All right, so question number five. What does Korach's need of status say about the fulfillment he was finding in his current role? Danielle?
Wasn't satisfied.
He was not doing it for him. He was not, apparently that was not cutting it. And he felt inadequate. And he felt a lack. And not just a little lack, but a profound lack, which, of course, motivated him to start this campaign, this rebellion. Okay, we're going to do the classic approach, Rashi's approach on this. There are many approaches here. Everybody agrees that he was egotistical and he was jealous and he had a lack. But the question, what was the cause of that? So Rashi gives a midrashic answer, which you should be familiar with. Sort of like this is sort of in the Midrash 101 on the Korach story. Here we go. All right, Danielle, read it out. Rashi on Parsha.
Dathan and Abiram, since the tribe of Reuven was settled in the south and they camped, thus being neighbors of Kohat and his children who were also camped in the south, they joined with Korach in his rebellion. Woe to the wicked and woe to his neighbor.
Okay, so Rashi's in dealing with what question? There's an implied question in the pasuk of, and going back to the first verse of the thing, what is bothering Rashi?
Who are the people that rebelled?
Well, the Torah says who they are, but what there's something which is kind of strange. Anybody?
Why Reuven's descendants were also...
Yeah, why these dudes? I mean, the Jewish peoples, there are 12 tribes. There's, at least 600,000 men. Why are these guys joining the coalition? So Rashi brings down the Midrash number one, is that basically they were neighbors. And it says, woe to the wicked... woe to the neighbor, which in Hebrew sounds a lot better. Oy la Rasha, oy la Shcheino. Woe to the wicked and woe to his neighbor. In other words, one thing is to be wicked, like Korach, and we're going to explore him in the next Rashi. But apparently, and this is something which is a very critical lesson, is that what is the assumption of that phrase, woe to the wicked and woe to his neighbor?
Surround yourself with?
Yes, why?
Because you're
going to
be influenced by the people that you're closest to?
Yeah. Step one, man is a social animal. Step two, we are consciously and unconsciously affected by the values, activities, opinions of who we spend time with. So if your neighbor is Korach, that's not going to end well. Now, is Korach a smart guy or a average guy? And what's your proof?
I think he's a smart guy.
And
what? Yeah. He had all the most respected people in his team.
Jen is correct. Very good. Because if you can get 250 other leaders to join your coalition, that means you have to be an extremely adept at persuasion, at debate, at rhetoric, at getting people to see your way. So, Korach's a very powerful and therefore dangerous guy. And if you're under his sphere of influence, you're going down. Nobody beats the Wiz. Okay? All right, so do you understand that? So that's something very, very important. It's a very basic lesson, but it's always valuable to look, you know, when you at the end of the day, who are you spending time with? And you can decide, you know something? That person does not bring out my best. That person might bring out, you know, my bad habits, and I don't think I should spend as much time with that person as I am. It's something because it's very subtle. It's very, very subtle. It's not. It's mostly happening unconsciously.
I mean, honey, I know this is a tangent, so you don't need the answer right now. But Hashem is the one who told Moshe and who told the tribes in which order they should, you know, surround the Mishkan. So these Reuven, I mean, they were put in this spot for a reason.
Right. Because they were put in the spot based upon rank. You know, look, obviously not everybody in the tribe of Levi is bad. You know what I mean? The Levi, by definition, were a good tribe. They, in fact, got the job of service in the Mishkan from the firstborn. That was a couple parshiot ago where the firstborn got, quote-unquote, let go. And in their stead became the Levium. So Levium in general are outstanding people. That's why they're entrusted with the national service. But Korach, as an individual, not so good. And then let's go right into the Midrash right now to see what Rashi's Midrash theory of that is. Go ahead.
Now, what made Korach decide to quarrel with Moshe? He envied the chieftainship of Elizaphan, the son of Uziel, whom Moshe appointed as chieftain over the sons of Kohath by the divine word. Korah claimed, "My father and his brothers were four in number, as it says, the sons of Kohath were. Amram was the first, and his two sons received greatness, one a king and one a Kohen Gadol. Who is entitled to receive the second position? Is it not I, who am the son of Izhar, who is the second brother to Amram? And yet, he appointed to the chieftainship the son of his youngest brother. I hereby oppose him and will invalidate his word."
So according to this Midrash, the Midrash Tanchuma, what made Korach furious? What made Korach furious? Not his sibling, but literally his cousin. In other words, Kahat had four kids. Amram is the first. Yitzhar, his dad, is the second. And meanwhile, who became the head of the who became the tribe, the tribal head of Levi? Was it who should it have been? Korach. But not only did he not go to the child of the number two son, he went down to the child of the number four son. So he was completely skipped over. Okay? Which gets to question number one. Let's have somebody read that. Let's who can see that? All right, Jessica. Can you see the Rashi, the question on Rashi? All right, Alex?
Let's see. According to... You mean question number one?
Question number one.
Yeah, according to Rashi, why did Korach think he deserved a higher rank? What metric did he use in choosing the rank of a person?
Okay, so what's the answer? Right, he's a birth order. He felt that he should be become the chieftain of the tribe of Levi because he's the oldest son of the second son of the second brother. Okay, that gets us to question number two. What metric did Moshe use? Or more accurately, what metric did Hashem use? Did he base it upon birth order?
No.
He based it on what frame? What metric?
He based it on the type of person that you were. I think he based it on your actions more than, just because it was meant, technically meant for you doesn't mean it was right for you.
Correct. In other words, and that really is, you'll see, I'm going to put a number of examples here. The entire book of Bereshit is... Instead of going by the Bechor, the firstborn, the Bechira, the selection, is based upon not birth order, but perfection. Who is the best person for the job based upon the merit? So when Avram had two children, he had Yishmael and Yitzchak. Who should have been the leader of the family? Who should have been the leader of the family? All things being equal.
Yitzchak.
No.
So his brother.
Yishmael. Yishmael is the firstborn. He should have been, the assumption is the default setting. Let's call it the Times New Roman setting of leadership goes by the firstborn. So it should have been Yishmael, who was the first child, and that was Avram's expectation. Lo and behold, Sarah tells Avram, nope, not Yishmael, Yitzchak. And then Hashem says, listen to Sarah. She is correct.
Same with Yaakov and Esau.
Other than that, who should have been for her? Who should be the leader? Who did Yitzchak think should be the leader?
Well, Esau was entitled to the birthright.
Right, but not only the birthright, he should be selected to be the leader of the family. Right, or at least a coalition of both. That he will be he take care of the practical leadership, the government, and right. This and the spiritual co-captain will be Yaakov, and that's what Yitzchak believed. Surprise! What did Rivka, his wife, based upon the prophecy that she got? What did she communicate to our good friend Yitzchak?
Changed it up a little.
And that what? Does Esav have a role in the leadership of the family?
No.
Not at all. It's all Yaakov. And then Yaakov had to go on a little journey to be able to become capable of, he had to learn in the school of Lavan University, how to do that. Then we get to the 12 brothers. Who should be the leader of the family? Reuven is the oldest. But as a story, there's a story about how he basically acted in a very impetuous manner. Who should have been after Reuven? Who's number two? Who's the second tribe? Anyway,
Levi.
What?
Levi.
Levi's number three. Who's number two? Shimon. Yeah, Simeon. Shimon is number two. So why did Shimon and Levi not get the role of leadership?
Because when they attacked Shechem at the Kitten of Onassus,
Exactly. When they act with great aggression, by saving their sister Dina, they killed the entire menfolk of the town of Shechem, which Yaakov at the end of his life said, "You're cursed be your anger." So they're fired. Who's next? Reuven, Shimon, Levi. Who's number four? Come on, guys.
Judah.
Does he become a leader?
Yes,
he does. Now he's, and there's a co-leader. Who else was giving leadership?
Yosef
is correct. So the two, so the firstborn of the tribe, the firstborn of his wife Rachel, and the fourthborn of his wife Leah, because they all lost it. So here's the key point. Here's the key takeaway. This is a key takeaway because we're at 9:02. The bottom line is that if Korach had tzniut, had modesty, had a sense of contentment with the portion that he had a sense of like I have as Moshe says, you've been separated from the community of all of the Jewish people to serve in the Mishkan. You have plenty. Rav Lachem, Shevet Levi. You have a lot of stuff. And now but that's not enough. You want to have to be the Kohen Gadol, the high priesthood. So basically, due to Korach's lack of fundamental humility, sniyut, he had a sense of a egotistical need that could not be satisfied with his exalted status, and therefore he could not tolerate the fact that he's not the chosen one, and he had to basically say that Moshe basically self-dealing. He's a nepotistic leader. He's sticking in his older brother because they're buddies, they're brothers. And that's the deal. So the point of the matter is that the takeaway for us is that when we engage in mitzvot, whether they are between ourselves and our fellow or ourselves and Hashem, we have to keep in mind, we have to ask ourselves one question. The way that I am performing this mitzvah, am I doing it to maximize the inner meaning, the inner value of the mitzvah, or am I using it for a act of marketing, self-promotion, egotism? You know what I'm saying? In other words, to put in another phrase, Pirkei Avot says something which is very strange. Sonei et harabanut, which means you should hate any position of authority or power. In other words, you do not run after positions of authority. Basically, if nobody else will do it, then you do it. But basically, it should not be for a personal gratification. That I want to be famous. I want to be well known. You know, and unfortunately, the leaders that we got in America, it's all about people who are stepping over each other to get greater limelight, unfortunately. It's a major motif, unfortunately. But on our personal religious lives, whether we deal with our... So therefore we have what the Gemara says... There is our sniyot with service of Hashem, mitzvot, and there's sniyot in our sexual sniyot. Those are both important, but ironically, and I'm underlining this because it doesn't get enough play, is that how we conduct ourselves in our mitzvah lives is equally as significant as we conduct ourselves in our, you know, in our sexual sniyot. Okay, so but they have the same concept. The goal of Judaism, a person have a private person, and a private relationship with Hashem. It's not for other people's, you know, not to impress other people. Now, obviously, nobody's perfect, and, you know, people like recognition, but the first step of dealing with a problem is to be aware of that. What's the goal? The goal is to try to be as sneered in our contact in our service to Hashem. And Korach, who was the complete opposite, was not sneas. He did not. He was unsatisfied with what the role that he got. Built the coalition with his tremendous political and rhetorical skills, so he can get more power. And unfortunately, as you know, he was swallowed up as the parsha continues. All right. Any questions? Is that clear? Okay. All right. So that's the. And you should know the Hebrew. Tznias. Hatznea lechet im elokecha. Walking humbly with God. And the principle being in the mitzvot which are public, and certainly the mitzvot which are private, and certainly in all of our conduct. And that's really. And Korach is the complete opposite of that. So, by the way, because people think, well, sneas is only with women. Wrong. Men have to be sneas too. He was the greatest non-sneas person in the Torah. Whether he took off his shirt, or he didn't take off his shirt, or he wore pants or didn't wear pants, doesn't make a difference. That guy is the opposite of the sneas guy. Is that clear? Aren't you trying to...
That's a question.
Yeah.
So you said... commandment, we found it in the prophet. So does that mean it's not part of the second
or 15th commandment? Oh, excellent question. So let me expand your question. So Jenna asked, all the mitzvot have to come in the five books of Moses. This statement of tznius is expressed in the later prophets. So does that mean that there's no idea of tznius? So the answer is that tznius is a concept which is implicit in the five books of Moses, but the book of Micah, expressed in a very clear way. They're not expressing a new concept, they're expressing an existing concept already. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's why the Talmud says, oh, the Torah says, the Torah did not say, it's the prophet. It's trying to say, that was the best. They used that verse in the prophets to articulate that, let's call it that a priori concept, that foundational concept. We see already was by Sarah that she is acting tzniut. There are many examples of tzniut that you see in the Torah. But the book of Micha expresses it in a much more overt way. All right, but it's an excellent question. All right, is that clear, guys?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, we'll continue. I'll see you guys tomorrow, or many of you guys tomorrow. All the best.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Good night. Thanks, Baba.